Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo's latest, Life and Art, is a thoughtful and funny collection of essays that explore the deeply personal side of a writer's life. Known for books like Empire Falls, Nobody's Fool, and Straight Man, Russo has long chronicled working-class America with wit and empathy and a sharp eye for character. In this collection, he turns his gaze inward on his childhood in Gloversville, New York, on the teachers who shaped him, and on the writing life itself. Richard Russo is the author of 9 novels, most recently Somebody's Fool, Chances Are, Everybody's Fool, and That Old Cape Magic, as well as 2 collections of stories and the memoir Elsewhere. In 2002, he received the Pulitzer Prize for Empire Falls. We spoke with Richard Russo at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut, in an event presented by Oblong Books, and I began by asking Richard Russo how he knew when this essay collection was ready to publish.
Well, when you have a chance to delve into it, you will discover that it is, in many respects, a pandemic document, starting right with the first essay in it. I think that there were maybe 3 essays in it that were published before the pandemic, but just about everything else in here is related in some way, shape, or form to the pandemic, if only in the sense that when the pandemic happened and we were all told to go home and stay there, what happened to me was, the first thing that happened to me was I looked at my next 2 months' schedule of things that I had agreed to do in a weak moment, and it was all gone. Every obligation I had for the next 2 or 3 months was gone. I suddenly had time on my hands. I was working on a novel, but for some reason, usually when I'm working on a novel, I will get to a point in the novel where something is amiss and I can't figure out what it is, and rather than stare at it and swear at it, I'll do something else. I'll write a pilot screenplay, or I'll write some short stories, or I'll write something else. For some reason, when it came time, when I was working on that novel and felt that I needed to do something else, the essay form was just suddenly there. And it was there in a very strange but very profound way. And this collection came together really pretty quickly. And I had no designs from the beginning of writing a book that was kind of half about life and the other half about art. But once I began to, you know, push them out, I was looking through them and suddenly they just fell into one of those 2 categories of things that were part of my lived experience, and others just meditations on art, which were, I think, important to me during the pandemic. As I say in one of these essays, my friend and colleague Ann Patchett and I, in our last book tours, we overlapped and we had several events together, and we were both experiencing the same thing at the time, which was, at a time when we're watching America and the world go to shit, how do we pretend that what we do on a daily basis, which is spin stories, how do we pretend to ourselves that these things matter? And we came up with a mantra that we agreed to, which was that if it mattered before, it still does. If it doesn't now, it probably never did. And we thought, well, we'll just say these, we'll say this to ourselves every morning and hope that it's true. And I think that over time, both Anne and I have come to the same conclusion. We do have to say the mantra every day still, but I think we've come to the conclusion that is much more true, I think, than our fears, which is that when things are darkest, art doesn't matter less, it matters more. And so that's the conclusion that we've, thank you. That's the conclusion that we came to, and that we try as best we can after reading at least the short version, the morning version of the New York Times. About all I can take most mornings. But after that, the thing to do is sit down and do what we've been doing all along.
The essays do seem, many do seem to have a searching quality, a pondering quality mm-hmm. to
yeah.
what is happening in that moment and how, just what you said, but how we should, how we are and how we should be reacting to what
mm-hmm.
is happening around us, which doesn't make any sense.
You don't know what to say, and if you did know what to say, it would be unspeakable.
Especially if you have an FCC license.
That's right.
Yeah. Essays that first appeared in Harper's Magazine,
mm-hmm.
check. Scribd, check. America Magazine, Atlantic, Vintage Shorts, Nonfiction Original. And then the Journal of American Psychoanalytic Association. How'd you get on that mailing list?
Strangely enough, the editor of one of the other pieces in this book, one of the longer pieces in this book called Marriage Story, if I'm remembering this correctly, and I have to say at 75, my memory is a bit more porous than it was 10 years ago. But if memory serves, the editor of the one of the longer pieces in this book, which is called Marriage Story, the editor of that piece was, I believe, at Scribd. And then she went to, and Scribd was, I think, at the time, and it always was purely electronic. It was just, there was no paper version of that magazine. But then she left and went to this new venture at the American Psychoanalytic Association. And zipped me an email one day and said, I'm at this new venture. You wouldn't happen to have anything, would you? And that was just about the time I was finishing up that essay, and I zipped it off to her. But I can imagine why it would raise your eyebrows. How in the world?
I don't know anything about the publication other than I would assume that that would have been a well-received issue.
Well, I don't know. I you would think that with that title, that one of the absolute requirements would be that if you're going to send something to the American Psychoanalytic Association, there would have to be at least one footnote in it, wouldn't there? it sounds just really scholarly to me. Back when I was working on my scholarly dissertation at the University of Arizona back in 1977. And yet, here I am without footnotes in that journal.
You write in Triage, I was once asked in an interview, what's the best thing about being a storyteller? That's easy, I replied. You get to cheat, to live many lives, not just the one you're born to. Ah, the interviewer nodded, understanding perfectly. So it's the same as reading. Yes, exactly. Your interior life, where time and space operate differently. The life in your head, or perhaps your soul, the most private places you have, that you never show in its entirety to anyone. For some, and not without reason, it's a place to steer clear of, and to the extent that you're able to manage that, an inner life can seem almost vestigial. For others, it's a place of strength and solace. For a few, artists in particular, it's the whole point of living. You're in the latter category.
I hope. That's my aspiration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when did you realize that?
When did I realize that I was going to be a writer?
When did you realize that this is, okay, this is it. This is the reason I'm here.
It came rather late in the scheme of things. My parents, as I detail in this essay called Marriage Story, my parents were two people who could see eye to eye on absolutely nothing. My father was a World War II vet, came back a bona fide war hero. My mom, who when the war was over, was nothing if not aspirational, and she had my life just mapped out. So we were going to escape from Gloversville, New York, where both she and I grew up. We were going to go out west somewhere. I was going to become an academic, which I did before becoming a writer. I did a BA, an MA, and a PhD in American literature before ever writing a story. So that life that she wanted for me was one that I lived for as long as I could. She didn't want me to become a writer. She wanted me to become that academic that I already was. And I think to a certain extent, I broke her heart when I became a writer, because she always thought of going away, becoming educated, learning a new language, because she knew that the language of Gloversville, New York was not the language that I wanted to speak if I wanted to get ahead. The language of a small mill town was not the language that I would be that she wanted me to speak or that would get me ahead. And so I learned that new academic language. At some point, I just realized it wasn't a language I wanted to speak. And the language that I wanted to speak was closer to the language that I spoke back in Gloversville, New York, the place we escaped from, the language that I spoke with my father and his friends on various, believe me, many bar stools. And that was the language that I was born to speak. And the stories that I was born to tell were of that life. And all I can say is that I owe both of those people, my mother, whose aspirations for me were responsible for most of the successes that I've had in life, but also my father, who had a certain kind of wisdom of his own. He believed until his dying day that the deck was stacked against people like him. He worked with his hands his entire life. His body, by the end of his life of hard physical labor, was bruised and broken beyond belief. And he still believed that America hadn't really changed that much after the war, as my mother thought it had. And he still believed with a certain, I think, sense of reality that the cops still waited outside of blue-collar drinking dives,
yeah,
and not outside the kind of upscale restaurants and bars.
The country clubs.
Yeah. And so, at some point, I was in the English department at the University of Arizona, finishing my academic dissertation. I walked across the hall to creative writing, knocked on the door, and said to the director of creative writing, "I think I might be interested in telling stories." And he said, "Well, give me one." And I did, and it was awful, and he told me why, but it was too late. That's the thing about art, I think, in general, that a lot of people don't understand, is that when you're bitten by the bug, it generally happens at least a decade before you're good enough to do anything about it, anything productive. You feel this incredible sense of must. I'm doing the right thing. And for me, I was around 30, and it felt like, all right, 30 years I've spent the last 10 years studying, but now suddenly I'm doing the right thing. And I could give nobody anything that was by way of evidence that would have suggested that it was the right thing. Because my work during my early apprenticeship was terrible, because I had no idea who I was or who I loved. And you have to discover that first. And it's a long, for me, it was a long road. John Cheever published the first story that he ever wrote in The New Yorker. And that's just showing off. I'm sorry.
But it makes you stronger, doesn't it? The fact that you lived that time and were able to go through that. And when I say stronger, I mean both physically, mentally, and creatively.
I think so. It was difficult in the sense that from the time I knew I wanted to be a writer and had to be a writer and wanted to be a certain kind of writer, the difficulty had more to do with the reality of paying bills, because by that time I was married. When I was working on my first novel, Barbara was pregnant with our first daughter. And before very long, and of course, I was followed out of graduate school with the money that I still owed on my government student loans and all of that. Those followed me around for a while. And the main problem that I had was that I had to teach full time, teaching four courses each semester, seven of those freshman composition. So the main problem was finding time to do the thing that I absolutely had to do, but I had to do it.
Richard Russo is our guest. The name of the new book is Life and Art Essays. It is published by Knopf. You mentioned your mother and her thoughts. I'm interested in your father. He did not see your success.
No.
And that time on the bar stool that you spent, in the way you have described it here and the way you've described it in your past work, but also in this collection, that he would think of you as an elite.
Well, I don't know whether he would think of me as an elite or not. I know that by the time I finished my PhD and would come back and visit him in my tweed jacket and corduroys, I looked different to him than when I was working road construction with him all those summers. And in that sense, he probably suspected that I now belonged to a different tribe, just as the result of my personal appearance. But more than that, the fact that he died before my first novel came out, he knew I wanted to be a writer, but he had no idea that I ever would be. I think his general response, more than now he belongs to a different tribe, I think his response would have been, "Where's my cut?" Because, and of course he had no idea how often I would use him in my fiction in the coming years, that Sam Hall from The Risk Pool was based on my father, Sully was based on my father. But even more importantly than that, I got some of my first valuable lessons in art and in writing from him during those years that I was going back and working with him on road construction. I was one of a bunch of college kids that worked in the laborers' union summers, and we were constantly made fun of. We would arrive with soft hands and we were just out of shape. Our work boots, we would be bloodshod after the first week, because our work boots would just, we'd be limping around, we'd be made terrible fun of. But also a number of interesting things happened as a result of that. We were the butt of all kinds of jokes, but then things would happen on the job that would be funny. And because we worked in Albany, and I stayed with my grandparents at the time, but we were living in Gloversville. Do you have any idea how many roadhouses there are between Albany and Gloversville? It's only an hour away, but there's like 3 hours worth of them. And we would, on the way home, Joe, my father would often tell a story, often at my expense or one of the other college kids' expense. We would stop at the first roadhouse and he would tell the story. And people would laugh. And then we'd move on to the second roadhouse where he'd have a second, not completely, but mostly different second audience. But I would notice that when he told the story in the second roadhouse, it wasn't quite the same, because he remembered what got a laugh in the first roadhouse.
It was workshopping.
That's right. That's absolutely. Then the third roadhouse, it would be a little different still. All the time, he's just pulling in, and he's also making the story more his. Each time he tells the story, he's more central to it in some way than he was in real life. And sometimes, if nothing else funny happened over the next couple of days, there would be several days of him telling this story in various roadhouses on the way home. And sometimes he would, even at the end of like 2 or 3 days, he would tell the story to me, even if the story happened to me. And I would say, "Dad, you realize, don't you, that I was there that this happened to me. And he'd always have this kind of stunned look on his face because it didn't belong to me anymore. It belonged to him. And that was my first important lesson in art. I mean, it's called revision, right? It's called workshopping. He just workshopped the story until it belonged to him and him alone. And the reason that I think he would want to know where his cut was because this was something he did for shits and giggles. He had no idea you could make a living doing what he did for just fun from a bar stool for his own entertainment and for other people's entertainment. And that's partly why I am the kind of writer that I am. I'm considered a literary writer, and I guess that's apropos. But my audience now, I'd like to think, isn't that different from his audience all those years ago.
One of the things that strikes me is that perhaps, as you said, of how many times he became that you were writing about your father and you realized you were writing about your father. And how present he is in your fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But you came to that realization later. It was almost looking back on that. That wasn't something that was immediate to say, oh, this is Dad.
Yeah. I mean, put simply, I missed him.
Yeah.
I missed his companionship. I missed his sense of humor. I not only missed him, I loved his friends. Those guys who worked road construction, they were some of the funniest human beings I have ever run across in my life. They stumped around in these broken bodies, doing incredibly hard work that nobody paid the slightest attention to. I think Joe, as angry as I have ever been in my life, and I cannot remember which book it was, but Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert were talking about one of my novels, and I don't remember which one it was, and I think it was Ebert, but I'm not sure. It could have been Siskel. One of the comments that he made was that what didn't ring true to him about the class of people that I was writing about was that they were so witty and so funny. And if I'd had him, I'd have shot him right between the eyes. Because, I mean, he thought he was saying something, number one, he thought he was saying something about the characters in my book, and I think he thought he was saying something about me as an artist. And he was really saying something about himself. And his own lack of lived experience that would have allowed him to come to such a ridiculous opinion. I would have slapped him right in the. I'll pull it back. I wouldn't have shot him between the eyes, but his ears would have rung.
It's so moving though to hear you say of the love, and because I both my parents have passed, and you have those different relationships with your mother and your father.
Yeah.
I had such a close relationship with my mother. I had a very close relationship with my father. It's just a different relationship.
Yeah.
But what you miss and how you miss it and how you realize it fits into your life is something that could wind up in the psychoanalytic association.
You think I have more work to contribute to that particular periodical?
I think we all have more work to do to figure out, right? Of where, because we come by this stuff honestly.
Absolutely. At least I hope we do. Yeah.
Yeah. When you are writing an essay, because this is also a very political book. I mean, mm-hmm. you are writing about, you're writing this during the pandemic. You're writing this during a very tumultuous time in our history. Hey, guess what? It still is.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you're trying to figure that out. And if there is a Siskel-like anger that can come out, now's the time, right?
Anger, I would hope is textured with humor, because so often, I mean, what what bullies don't like is to be laughed at.
Yeah.
Some of these essays are very dark, and some of these essays are very dark indeed. Others are more whimsical, even when dealing with very serious subject matter. One of my favorite essays in the piece is I think it's very serious indeed. It's an essay called "The Future," and it's about disruption. And my God, have we been in the middle of disruption since before the pandemic, really? But certainly during the pandemic, and now, and everything that's happened since the insurrection. We have, and I think that there's no particular reason to believe that the disruption is going to be lessened in any way, because we're now going to have to start dealing with artificial intelligence, which is going to be yet another form of disruption that is going to send a lot of people reeling. We just learned the other day that some of the people who are being affected most by artificial intelligence are those people who write code. And I'm not sure that anyone would have necessarily predicted that. You would have thought that they would have been kind of among the most protected people
right
out there, but it turns out that that's not so. So what does one do when you find yourself in the middle of a kind of disruption that threatens not only your life, but probably an awful lot of the lives of an awful lot of people you know, and a lot of people certainly who are just like you? Very serious subject.
Richard Russo's latest is Life and Art Essays, published by Knopf. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Thanks also to the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut, and Oblong Books in Millerton and Rhinebeck, New York. oblongbooks.com. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.